Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hello, this is Julian Castelli. I'm the host of the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast, where each week we talk with inspirational entrepreneurs and leaders in the tech industry. Past guests have included CEOs and CXOs of great companies like Workfront, CHG Healthcare, Retica Systems, InMoment, RetailMeNot, the San Francisco 49ers, and many more. This episode is brought to you by Growth Elevated. Growth Elevated is a community of tech founders, CEOs, and CXOs who are committed to working together to share best practices and learnings in an effort to help all of us become better leaders. We do this through educational programs like this podcast, as well as our blog and our annual tech summit, which happens to be at the base of beautiful Alta Mountain in Utah this year. If you'd like to learn more, and if you enjoy skiing and networking with other tech leaders, come check us out at growthelevated.com and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, I'm super excited to introduce Jonathan Fishman. Jonathan is a three-time founder and a leader in financial legal tech. He has brought fintech workflows into mid-sized law and professional service firms to streamline their financial operations. Now he's focused on the next wave of innovation, and that's embedding banking and financial management to help these industries. Jonathan is based in Boise, Idaho. He's an avid skier and mountain biker, and he's obsessed with finding used clothing on eBay. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, Julian. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on today. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about Lien Law. This is a SaaS company for law firms, correct?
It is, yeah. From the outside looking in, we're a timekeeping and billing company that helps law firms manage the full financial life cycle of its clients, from how they onboard, track their time, produce the bill, collect the money, and all the derivative reporting. But really what that is wrappered, that commodity of timekeeping and billing invoicing is wrapped around what we call a fintech workflow company. So what our DNA is to think about what we can automate, what we can integrate with, and what the data opportunities. And we wrap that mindset around the key financial workflows of law firms and other upmarket professional services firms. So we're that financial operating system that's helping these law firms manage the full financial life cycle of their clients.
Awesome. Well, I know that law firms, that's not their primary focus. So they definitely need a good set of tools to keep their business running. And I'm sure you're helping them figure out exactly how to do that. Where'd this idea come from? Do you come from the legal industry?
I don't. The original founder is a gentleman named Gary Allen. He was a Stanford graduate and practiced in a mid-sized law firm and had the classic founder story of seeing the pain of the industry. He was watching his own practice with the yoke of overhead and saw how boomers were aging out and millennials and Gen Xs were coming into positions of authority within law firms, and saw that change had to happen. As you mentioned, lawyers in particular are not known to be great business operators. And so he saw, the technology change happening, how folks wanted to behave differently and interact with tools differently. But he also saw a generational change happening. We were introduced via mutual mentor. I got very excited about his business, having my own entrepreneurial background. And we became, fast friends and started Lien Law with a third person, a CTO, a gentleman named Fred Willerup.
Fantastic. And that was when?
That was 2015.
Okay. So you're about 8 or 9 years into it at this point. So you started with three of you?
Yeah. And it's an interesting story. I mean, for the first, I would say, 5-6 years until about 2021 and 2020, we were fairly part-time.
Okay. So it's an idea?
Yeah, Gary was still practicing law, and I had another company on our side, and we had raised a little money, but we weren't fully in the business. And in 2020, you had one of those cathartic moments where you're like, are we in or are we out? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the second generation of Lien Law happened. And I became the CEO in the fall of 2021. and began to put it on its course of where it is today.
So that's an interesting thing. A lot of people have ideas on the side, you know, particularly if you have an entrepreneurial background like yourself. But yeah, you were kind of cultivating this or nursing it, but you weren't all in. What made you go all in?
You know, we had put a lot of work into it, and there was a lot on the table. And you know, even though we weren't quote unquote all in, we were still very consumed in the business. But there becomes a moment where you get to this point and you're saying, hey, we either have to be all in or not. And I think we had so much on the table that we weren't willing to give it up. I think that was one motivation. Two, the bones of the business were there, you know, product market fit, revenue, high retention, interesting market and TAM, unique product in the market. So all of the goods were there. But, and this is the challenge. I mean, and this is what a lot of early stage companies deal with. We didn't have everyone in the right people in the right seat. And mm-hmm. One of the challenging things that we had to do is saying, you know, what was the leadership team looking like? Who was going to lead the company and where were we going to move forward? And that was a thoughtful, but challenging discussion, as it always is when people change roles. And that was part of the decision where I said, candidly, you know, and this was also because of some pressure from outside sources and investors saying, hey, we need the right leader in the right seat for the organization. And I didn't have to be me. I was in the company, but it needed to be a person who was ready to lead. So when you talk about that, you know, making that decision, there was certainly a lot on the table to be optimistic about, but it was also a commitment about making sure we had the right leadership to take the company from where it was to where it needed to go.
Was there a financing deadline or event that kind of served as a catalyst to make sure you had a full-time leader? And where were you being in terms of taking outside money at this point, and how did that play a role in terms of the evolution?
In the early stage of our company, we did a lot of seed investing from local, we call it the Treasure Valley here in Boise, which is Boise and the surrounding communities. And it's not a hard community to get your hands around. And as we got into 2020, from 2015 to 2020, the community matured. And, you know, we had gotten to a point where we still needed some outside capital to be funded. Then there wasn't a lot of optimism and energy to invest in the way the leadership structure was set up. And so that was part of the catalyst, but it was also, this was an interesting moment. And I think it's worthy to share with the team. At that same time, we adopted the EOS management methodology.
Oh, yeah, that's a great one.
And so this was a very important catalyst. So not only, candidly, was I dissatisfied with how we were operating, I just happened to meet an EOS implementer, and he handed me a book. It wasn't to meet him to do EOS. He was just someone I was meeting in the community. And he's like, have you ever read Tracker?
Explain what EOS is for our audience, please.
Yeah. So I'm sorry. Thanks. EOS is called the Entrepreneur's Operating System. And it was a book. It's a methodology for managing companies based off of a book by Gino Wickman called Traction. And it's spurned as almost cult-like. You almost sound evangelical when you're talking about EOS, but it significantly transformed our company. But one of the key principles which helped in this conversation is they don't like to use the word CEO or COO. I mean, it's still used for outside. They use this idea of a visionary and an integrator. And the visionary typically sits in the CEO seat, and they have a very strategic, very extroverted mindset. But they tend to be really bad at operations, and facilitation, or that's not their joy. I shouldn't say bad. It's not their joy and passion. Integrator is the opposite. They certainly can be strategic, but they're really meant to be someone who is internal to the company, operating and executing, kind of like a COO might be. And so as we adopted that framework, we had kind of three forces going. One was, you know, we needed to still raise capital, and there was some not great enthusiasm towards the company. Two, we needed to make a decision to get in or out. And three, we are adopting this framework that's saying, hey,
it gave you the roles to figure it out. And you were the visionary, is that right?
Yes, I was. And I say that I don't love the title because it sounds very grandiose, but yes. And Gary Allen, our CEO at the time, was the integrator or took that role more. And what was interesting is, and this is what I think is, Julian, is really hard, is that when companies are founded, someone just because of either money or stature or idea gets put into a role of authority, whether it's CEO or some other thing, and the company will grow. And that can be some, that can be such a challenging and potentially really disruptive, if not, you know, imploding transition as leaders change roles as companies grow. And that's what was happening. We had to grow, we needed to grow faster, we needed to be more strategic. And what was fabulous was EOS gave us a vernacular and a framework, because we said, hey, we're interested in going into EOS and adopting this. That was a really important group acknowledgement between the three founders. And when we did, we had then a framework that wasn't emotional and wasn't, you know, personal to say, well, what do each role look like and what is the right person? And that's where, you know, when Gary and I were having these conversations, and he was amazing. I mean, he was very diplomatic and, you know, and very pragmatic as we approached it. But I said, Gary, you know, you're not the visionary. That's not who you are. And he said, yeah, I am. I'm not. And so that allowed us him a recognition to say, okay, that's what this role is and what it needs to do. And maybe that's not the best seat for me. And that allowed the company to begin to reshape its leadership team and move itself forward. So those three things were the driving factor in that moment of the company. And that's when we really started to grow. We've grown quite considerably since that moment.
That's excellent. Okay. So yeah, you have a founding group. You're right. It's very difficult to break that whatever hierarchy is created originally, but you found EOS, that gave you a third party framework, and then you found your roles that really felt like the best fits for each of your team members. Did you stay all three, or was it just two of you going forward?
No, all three are in the company, but in different roles. Yeah, and I really want to reinforce the importance of what EOS did. And I'm not suggesting everyone adopt EOS, but having some disciplined management framework categorically changed how we operated. Even before we had more maturity in our organizational execution, it allowed us to go through a certain cadence, yearlies and quarterlies and whatnot, that AOS does. And I if I say like key learnings, I know we're gonna talk about it later, but that's one
Let's hear them.
That's one of them that I wished I would have done sooner. No, it's too early, you know, as a three-person company, it'd be a little weird to do EOS in its fully formed self. But as you start to get, you know, as you start to get 5-10 people in your company, having that framework is so important, because not only does it help you operate better when you may not have excellent operators in the company yet, because you're still early stage and you're still all quick starts, but when you bring people in, you immediately have a framework which they know how to operate in. Mm-hmm. They know what they're supposed to do quarterly. They know what they call it, a VTO. They know what the VTO is, the vision, traction, organizer. They know, you know, essentially where the organization is going. So it helps accelerate. It helps and accelerates folks onboarding in the organization, and helps them, you know, be more productive sooner. I'm a big fan of EOS, and it's sometimes hard, because it doesn't fit perfectly with a software company, software as a service company, especially in engineering. Mm-hmm. But you know, you work through it. You don't have to be a purist.
Yeah, that's great. And did you guys hire a EOS specialist to work with you?
Yeah, they call them implementers, and absolutely. And that's, and it was a hard investment. I mean, it's, you know, it's a lot for a day. These implementers make a lot of money on a given day, but in particular, in the early stages, you know, a lot of people think, oh, we'll just kind of do an EOS light without an implementer. And it's really powerful to go in a room and have a solid implementer as a third party, you know, objective person facilitating all of the issue resolution. And that's, I think, was also very helpful in us becoming a much better company. And we've committed to it. We have an implementer we meet. We do three quarterlies, and then the annual is 2-day session every year.
Fantastic.
with our leadership team.
So, okay. So your EOS coach kind of helps you with your strategic planning every quarter and your yearly planning and keeping you on track. So was that a major turning point in terms of your company being able to execute, do you feel?
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, it was.
Well, give us some like before and after differences. What changed and what makes you say this is why it's working?
You know, I'm going to say two things that were really, I think, strong catalysts to growth. And it all comes down to very basic principles. You know, making sure you have a clearly outlined and well-articulated plan. You know, what's the yearly plan? What are the goals? Strategic planning, and EOS helps you frame that in what you're doing. That breaks down into what they call quarterlies, and quarterlies that have, you know, they call them rocks, but deliverables. So what EOS did is it aligned everyone strategically on where we were going, and we, on a very regimented cadence, set, you know, what our rocks, what our work was to achieve those goals. That was number one. So the strategic alignment with the deliverables were all aligned. Number two, it created a dashboard of metrics. They call it a scorecard that was brought clarity to the business. And to anyone listening to this, it takes iterations and iterations and iterations to get the right scorecard. And we're still iterating on our scorecard. Some things never change, you know, but when you start to understand how you're pushing the business, you start to work with your scorecard, and that helps you understand in a quick glance, you know, what are the most important metrics, but those metrics are shared by all. So mm-hmm. That was the second thing that EOS did, is that it helped us understand the data and narrow it down to what's most important, because it was tied directly to those objectives, right? You could do a one-to-one with those objectives. And then the third, I think, and this has a bit of a longer tail, is it really does give you a framework to ensure you have right person, right seat. They use core values, and they use something called the GWS, get it, wants it, capacity. Does the person get it? Do they want it? Do they have the capacity? And that uniformed framework for evaluating and managing talent was very helpful, because it's always subjective, right? I mean, there's data that says that it's not, but there's still subjective components to it. But when we would interview someone, we make everyone who's interviewing fill out the core values and rate them in core values. And then, do they get it? Do they want it? Do they have the capacity? And so it normalized what we were taught, what we were grading on.
It gave you some language, common language.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so when, you know, and capacity is a very esoteric, is not the right word, but the concept of capacity is very subjective. Yeah. And so when we would interview, especially when I was interviewing with junior people in the company, and we talk about capacity, I would always let everyone else go first. And I say, well, here's my concerns about capacity. And, you know, I remember this one time in particular that I had a different perspective, because I just have a different visibility, different scope of visibility. And it helped the other teammates understand why I wasn't so positive on that candidate. And it helped them understand
capacities, that capabilities of,
capacity could be, you know, do they have the time and energy to do it? Capacity could be, do they have the, do they have the ceiling to do it? Mm-hmm. Right. Someone can come in and learn and, okay, well, I think we can get to it. And you know, when you tie that, do they get it and do they want it and do they have the capacity, those three levers really help you frame it out. So capacity is sort of a subjective, do they have the ability to get it done today and tomorrow? And that could be a myriad of different drivers that helps you ask that question. And, you know, it's different for different roles and different jobs. So those are the three things that EOS did. And that was that. I think a second event happened. I can't remember the exact date, but it was approximately around there. I with two other people in the company went into an accelerator, and we had toyed with the ideas of accelerator, but this was a special one. It's called GrowthX, and it's one of the smartest venture capital firms I've ever met. Andrew Goldner, and I'm spacing the other gentleman's name right now, who had that firm. Andrew was my coach, and they bring in early stage companies. We were a little later stage for most. Typically, they're at idea form, and they go through a 3-month accelerator, and they're maniacal about ICP, understanding your ideal client profile, and the work that goes through that. And then because Andrew was my coach, I got all these sessions with him, and he's the managing partner of this venture capital firm. And what they do is obviously use that as deal flow.
Right.
They do a 3-month incubator with the teams, and they understand if it's a good idea, if they're coachable, do they want to work with them? And then on the backside, they can make investments. But they are phenomenal operators and educators. And so I came out of there with a vigor and spirit around really being honed in on our ICP, mm-hmm. And creating a love language to your ICP. And we still...
Yeah, you mentioned that. You said a love letter to your ICP. What does that mean? I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, and it sounds a little corny, but what it means is that, and I'll never forget it, the best example I can give you is as a trade show. We're legal, so it was the Association of Legal Administrators. And this woman walked up to me at the booth, and I started to talk to her. And as I was talking to her, you could feel everything that I was saying was representing and speaking to the pain that she feels every day in her job. Mm-hmm. And so as she talked and I talked about our solution, we were speaking the same language about how my work over the last 8 years and understanding how we believe law firms should operate and the tools and workflows that they should use aligned perfectly with how she was operating her firm, but she lacked this tool, LeanLaw, that would really overcome all of this pain. So the love letter was me expressing in our value prop, in our vision, exactly how we resolved her pain. And you know, she was perfectly in our ICP. So she was the right person in our ICP, and I was speaking in a fluid and very personal way because she could understand exactly. Yeah, I have.
Yeah, you're hitting the bullseye, right?
Right, and you know, of course, that's in person. It's at a trade show. It's under the perfect scenario. But you know, I think too many times, especially in early stage companies, it was our mistake is that we weren't maniacal about who our ICP was, and narrowing to get to that point where we really had a high value conversation and could, you know, very clearly and very easily sell. What we do, you know, this idea of changing out your timekeeping and billing is not a simple decision, right? This is not selling an add-on function tool that one or two people in the business use and you can, you know, zip it up and maybe sell it to some other folk, expand it into some other seats in the firm, like, you know, Fathom Video or Loom or some other tools that we use. This is their main instrument to track time and collect money on. So it's a big decision to transfer. And so you really have to be very clear about who it is that buys your product and how you communicate your value and how you overcome that. So GrowthX got me really tuned in to, got me tuned into ICP and ICP language in that love letter, because they were just hammering on it. And even though we were, you know, years into operations, and this is the lesson I learned, it's never, never too late to rethink your ICP, right? Yeah. It's never too late to refine your, you know, what you communicate to your clients. It's an ongoing process because it's always changing. The market's changing, the customer's right. changing, your company's changing. And I think too many times companies get a bit stagnated into where they are and aren't thinking about how their consumers are changing. This last point on the GrowthX. The other thing, and this was Andrew, he stuck into my head the importance of, and you know, of stage appropriate talent. And I didn't fully appreciate that at the moment, but how critical it is, especially in early stage companies, to have folks that have experience in stage appropriate. And the best example I can give you is we hired a senior level person in our company And he had a great pedigree, and we had used a recruiter, and we felt really good about the hire. And boy, we won. We got this person who's got these great skills, and he was highly effective and churned in less than a year. And when I went back and kind of thought about the mistake I made in that hire, he didn't have stage appropriate experience. And he couldn't.
Was he too senior or used to too big of a company? Was it too small of a company for him? Did he bang on the ceiling, or what was the issue?
He was too senior. And he didn't know how to operate in an early stage company. And even though he said all the right things in the interview about wanting to, you know, sell and be in it, he was never really committed to it and didn't know how to build a sales organization from that stage to where we need to go. And so it just became a key learning that as I think about hiring, I'm really regimented about it. It's more important in senior roles or very specific roles. So I want to be clear, when you hire a junior customer support person, stage appropriate experience isn't as critical. But when you still have key roles, especially in leadership, hiring stage appropriate is like one of my number one mantras. And, you know, for example, we're hiring a COO right now, and I will not hire someone if they haven't scaled from 2 to 10 in that period. I just won't. I don't care how good they might be or their pedigree, because it's just I don't want to pay for someone to learn those skills and that experience. I don't have the time and budget.
Well, they're unique, right? And so that's a critical stage. Well, that's neat. I hadn't heard that product market fit love letter, but you mentioned that earlier. So when you kind of get that reaction from a client, like the tears in the eyes, that's when you know you've got product market fit, right?
Yeah. I mean, and you know that you're saying that your messaging is right. I mean, you know, I did a ton of selling early on. That's what I did before I became the CEO. And when you had the right customer, it was such a fun experience.
Yeah, you're truly helping them. You're truly unlocking value.
Yeah. And that's, as the founder, you know, you created something from nothing. And to think that now you've got this solution that really impacts this business. And I mean, that's just joy. That's entrepreneurial joy. And when you don't have it, you know, it's really bad. It's going to, you know, even if you can close them, you know that there's downstream, it could be rocky for the company and the client, because maybe they weren't the right fit. So when you get your love letter, man, it is joyous.
How long ago was that when you kind of felt that lock in and product market fit?
That was 21. I think we did that. I mean, we had product market fit from a product standpoint. I mean, the thing that has kept Lean Law in business when, you know, candidly, maybe we shouldn't have been in business because we weren't operating as efficiently as we could, was our retention and the longevity of the product. I mean, it really does. It works, right? So there's, when you build a company, and this is, you know, my own naivete, because I hadn't done a SaaS company when I joined Lean Law. Again, stage appropriate skills, right? I didn't have stage appropriate skills and industry appropriate skills when I joined Lean Law. But when you build a product, there's kind of two pieces to it, right? There's the product market fit, like we go out and we bring a solution to market and some people buy it and they don't churn, right? And there's a whole product motion that you go about that. That's one piece of the business that has to get right. But in a SaaS company, then there's a second piece, which is your marketing and revenue waterfall, you know, from first impression all the way down to close win, to onboarding, to retention, customer success retention, through that whole customer journey. And those two pieces, you know, aren't always in harmony in SaaS companies, right? So we were really good in the early phase of building a product that had product market fit. And we had early success with clients and really strong retention numbers. And so it said, hey, there's something there. But what we stunk at, to be brutally honest, was our go-to-market, right?
Your go-to-market, your messaging and things?
It was beyond that. It's from the full customer journey, right? And it's, you know, from lead to, from impression to lead to MQL to SQL, the closed win to the onboarding to, you know, the handoff to customer success and long-term retention. And that whole journey, when we founded, you know, there was me who was kind of a sales guy, an entrepreneur guy. There was Gary, who was the subject matter expert, who was a lawyer. And then we had a CTO. And we never committed early on to bringing in someone who said, you own that waterfall. Mm-hmm. We brought in some pieces to it, but never someone who owned the revenue. We had a sales and marketing people, and that was one of the key learnings. And so from a SaaS company, and I would imagine any company, I think we get, it's important to get product market fit, but you can have an underperforming company with amazing product market fit that doesn't have a strong go-to-market. And those two things
right. happen. And across that whole customer journey, as you point out.
Right.
And I making sure that they're all mutually complementary and build on each other, right?
Yeah. And so I think when you talk about why I feel so good about our company right now is that, you know, we have an awesome product. And I can, you know, we get to see daily people using it through our data metrics. But, you know, what we've gotten much better at in the last, I'd say, 2 years, and particularly because we found the right person, right seat to lead the revenue team, was understanding this customer journey. And, you know, there's layers to it. And when you think about that revenue side, there one layer is, first and foremost, the data. And we stunk at the data for many, many years. We didn't understand our data on the go-to-market. And that's critical, right? It's understanding your waterfall and having someone who sits on top, who owns that data and can do actionable behaviors based on that data. I don't mean, hey, we're going to dial up and spend more money on ad spend. I'm talking about really understanding, okay, in this specific area of the funnel, like we had a problem mid-funnel. Mm-hmm. We would get lots of top of funnel impressions, and we have an incredible close rate down funnel once we get that client. But mid funnel was tough for us. Like,
who's that person who owns the data? Is that a RevOps leader or is that a sales leader?
Yeah, it's a gentleman in our company named Matt Newbell who is a RevOps leader.
So when did you add RevOps? Because I think that, you know, you're talking about the challenge of the full customer journey, connecting everything, getting kind of forensic about why things are getting stuck in stage. Yet small companies often feel like they can't afford RevOps. When did you hire RevOps and what's the impact of that hire, you think?
Okay, so I'm going to answer the question, then I'm going to give you a little backstory because I think it's important. We officially hired the right leader in 23, right as we funded. And it was right after we let go ahead of marketing and ahead of sales.
Okay.
So we, in our naivete, approached the business from a marketing function and a sales function.
Yeah, without them being integrated.
And that's our inexperience. And when we finally understood it was a RevOps function, that's when we started to really move. And it doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it's taken, you know, 18
months. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of details and
18 months to get the
CRM hygiene. Yeah, the challenge,
the
data, right?
The messaging and the people all aligned, right? But they, you know, we underspent on RevOps and overspent on marketing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what gets a lot of early stage companies confused is it's the whole customer journey. Mm-hmm. And that team has to be integrated and one person has to run it, in my mind. Someone has to own it. And, you know, that's if I talk about like, hey, what would have moved the company faster and what we should have invested in earlier was a strong RevOps leader way earlier in the business.
But really to just understand the data and create transparency into the whole customer journey.
Yep.
That's a great takeaway.
Yeah. And, you know, I talk about the two sides. We had product market fit. We have it, right? That was clear, but we didn't have the investment in the RevOps side and have the right leader in that seat to help elevate everyone around us. And we needed someone who was stage appropriate. So we hired this gentleman, Matt, and Matt, you know, did RevOps at T-Sheets, which was a company here in Boise that sold he was customer staff in RevOps, but he was the company that sold to Intuit for, you know, $200 or $300 million. He then was at a company called ConvertKit, which is, I think, called Kit now, which is a SaaS tool into the blogging world. And he had incredible growth there. And so he had the exact stage.
Yeah, the right experience. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, stage appropriate experience.
Mm-hmm.
I want your audience to hear that.
Yep.
Stage appropriate experience.
Well, that's awesome. That's a great story. Jonathan, thank you so much for sharing that. Looking forward to having you with us at Growth Elevated this year and seeing you on, having some good chairlift discussions. You had a lot of great takeaways here. What would you recommend in terms of books or podcasts or blogs if people want to learn more about what you've been sharing?
Well, there's lots of books. The one book that really has influenced me heavily from the very first minute I read it and saw the golden triangle, which was the golden circle, which was Simon Sinek's Start With Why.
Okay.
And I just so routinely go back to that over and over and over in my team. And I'll literally send it to them and say, okay, tell me why, not the how and the what.
Yeah.
What I pay attention to on a day in, day out basis, we didn't talk much about fintech workflow and embedded banking in this conversation, but I'm heavily looking at fintech and bank tech newsletters. There's one, I'm gonna probably mispronounce his name, but Linus, L-I-N-A-S, his newsletter is helping me understand what is happening in the fintech, bank tech, for us being a fintech workflow company, that's really critical. And then from a company and product perspective, I'm pretty vigilant about listening to Lenny's podcast. He's a product leader and talks a lot about product, but I think listening to some of the challenges that are articulated in solutions and thought leaders that are on his podcast, he's talking to some of the most influential people in the industry. So those are things that I pay attention to in terms of education.
That's great. Thank you so much for those.
Yeah.
All right, Jonathan. Well, thanks a lot for your time this morning, and we'll see you on the slopes in a month or two.
All right. Thanks, Julian. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.